Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. How are you today, Mom? And
I'm good. Sun shining.
Oh, it's cloudy here, and we're only 25 miles apart, so what's up with that?
Well, that's the way. You're living in Iowa, dear.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, we have a really fascinating book to discuss today.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I absolutely could. I could not put it down. I couldn't put it down.
Our guest is Matt Killeen. He's the author of Orphan Monster Spy, and it's his debut novel. Matt was born in Birmingham, which is in the United Kingdom. He says, back when trousers were wide and everything was brown. We'll have to ask him what color everything is now. And Matt's attempted to make a living as an advertising copyright and a largely ignored music and sports journalist, and he now writes for the world's best-loved toy company, as it wasn't possible to be an X-Wing pilot.
Oh, my goodness.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Matt.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. So what is an X-Wing pilot?
Oh, they are the rebel pilots in Star Wars. I saw Star Wars when I was 5 years old, and that just like exploded the little boy's brain completely.
Uh-huh.
And to be an X-Wing pilot was my ambition, and unfortunately, you know, it being fictional, that was not possible as a career path.
That's true.
Although I did spend a lot of time in college playing X-Wing, so I kind of minored in X-Wing.
So. Well, it sounds like you may have quite a few possibilities for other novels with your experience, with your life experience.
Yes, I think so. I've had a very diverse career. I've been a singer. I've been a designer. I've run a nightclub, and I was a laser tag professional for a very short amount of time, and then I was a filmmaker, and I ran events at my student union, and then I became an art director in advertising, and finally an advertising copywriter. And for the last 8 years, I've worked for the Lego company, writing comics and stories and stuff for Lego Club mostly. But I've taken the leap now. I'm a full-time author.
So, oh boy.
I'm getting... allowing the fear to provide, you know, the impetus for writing the sequel. So, you know.
Well, it seems like your character also used fear as her motivation in Orphan Monster Spy. Yeah. So, yeah. Orphan Monster Spy is set in Germany, and the main character is a young woman who becomes orphaned. What have you always had an interest in this period in history, or what drew you to write this story?
Well, I grew up in the 1970s in the UK, and at that point, you know, certainly from a child's point of view, it was a fairly war mad time. All the films that we'd want to come on a Saturday night, all the TV programs, all the comics that we read, all the stories and books that we read were all related to the Second World War. Even the shoes we wore to school were kind of war themed. They were called Clark's Commandos. Those are the ones that you had to have.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
At the same time, my mother's best friend was German, so we spent sort of many summers with her family, and they were warm and compassionate and wonderful hosts, and, you know, rabidly pacifist. You know, I couldn't play pirates or space marines or anything that involved like violence or weapons without a sort of stern talking to about where that might lead. And it was very difficult to square that experience of real German people with the way that they were depicted, you know, in the media from the 1940s. And I that was very confusing to me. And the more, as I grew up and I discovered more about the Third Reich and about the Holocaust, that dichotomy just grew even more sort of intense. And that kind of laid down like a lifetime's horrified fascination with the Second World War and with the Third Reich. So that's, you know, it's very much in my ballpark. And when I started to write, it was the area that just seemed most natural.
Mm-hmm. Now, Matt, Orphan Monster Spy is your debut novel, but is it the first novel that you wrote or just the first that you published?
It's an interesting question. I had a kind of sort of embryonic piece. I'd written some film scripts because I did film at university, and so I had a couple of film scripts lying around, and one that I particularly liked, but I could never make it work. And I kind of like had this sort of epiphany moment. I realized, oh, this is a story for children. This is why it's not working. And then immediately it just sort of all came to life. And I was sort of between, you know, advertising gigs at the time, and so I sort of wrote it. And it's very short, and it's a novella, and it's all over the place, and the tone goes up and down. And so there is somewhere in a drawer an early finished novella. But this is the first thing I would let other humans look at, basically. First one was just practice.
And what about your life brought you to the point where you felt ready to write a novel and publish it and make the leap to full-time writer? Was it just something that always was there and finally it happened, or was it more gradual?
Well, it took me a very long time to realize that writing was what I should be doing. I mean, looking back, I've been writing my whole life. Every career, everything that I've done has involved, you know, quite a lot of writing. I just never kind of considered its value. I think because it kind of came relatively easy to me in many ways that I kind of took it for granted. And it was almost by accident. I was in the UK. If you're an advertising creative, you have to work in teams. And I worked with somebody who was very much on the writing side, and I was very much on the design side. And then she quit, and I ran into another art director who was just, you know, leaps and bounds ahead of me in the design stakes. And he was also Swedish, so I said, well, I'll tell you what, you do the pictures, you do what you do, and I'll do the writing. And then that was like the scales fell away from my eyes. It was like, this is brilliant. Can I do this now for the rest of my life? Can I put words together? And and so that was a real epiphany moment. And and then later on I did more what they call long copy, because, you know, if you work for an fancy fancy advertising agency, you're only allowed to use 2 to 7 words. But of course there is actually and that's all that anybody gets trained to do, but of course there is, you know, paragraphs and paragraphs of text that somebody has to write, and no one knows how to string a sentence together anymore. So I spent a lot of time writing, you know, websites for German cars and that kind of thing. But it always felt like slightly limiting. I always knew that I had sort of more creative stuff I wanted to discuss. And I even when I started working for Lego, which was like a sort of lifetime's ambition, you know, I wanted to write something that had no restrictions, that there was nobody going, okay, you need to cut this, you know, cut most of this away, and that's too dark, and, you know, this isn't selling the product enough. And so I kind of had an idea of what I was going to do, but I realized that I needed to learn my craft a little bit if I was going to write in a longer form. So I did a master's degree in creative writing. And I had 3 years to write a book, and it took exactly 3 years, right up until the final night. And that's how I work. And so Orphan Monster Spy was born. And I kind of rewrote it a little bit over the next 2 years. And then, you know, I found my agent, and, you know, she's very, very good.
Wow. So were you doing the master's degree? Were you working at the same time, or did you go full time?
And I was working at the time. I did it by distance learning, so I was kind of having my lectures and workshops and stuff online, which is all very 21st century.
It is. Was there some residence portion of it where you go and get together and workshop too, or was it all online?
It was pretty much all online. There was no compulsion to spend any time at the university. I did go to a couple of events, and I had the cohort, the people I was working with, were just stunning. I mean, I don't know whether this is typical of a master's program or whether we just, whether it was just luck that I sort of hooked up with a group of, like, hugely talented, intelligent writers. Part of the book is dedicated to them in the acknowledgements. So
that sounds like a really great way to get into writing a book. You have support while you're going, because the writing can be pretty lonely.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it is very important to, to crit and learn to crit other people and be critted by them. One has trouble looking at one's own writing and going, that's what's the matter with that, and this is what I need to fix it. Whereas when you read somebody else's, you can spot what's wrong immediately. And,
isn't that the truth? I feel like I'm a much better editor than I am a writer.
Yeah. But when you do that, you're learning, just the process of doing that. And usually when somebody is critiquing your work, you'll go like, gosh, that's absolutely right. And so I think, joining a crit group is one of those essential things in becoming an author. I think it also helps, that to speak to some three-dimensional people from time to time and to be able to go like, oh, God, I can't stand my life. I'm writing all this stuff. I have, like, fictional characters that enrage me. What am I supposed to do with this? And I think it's good to speak to people who understand that,
So have you kept in touch with that cohort post-graduation?
Yes, absolutely have. I'm going on a writing retreat with them this summer. Anna Mannering has a book out in the US now called Rebel with a Cupcake. She's a hugely talented writer. One of our cohorts is now teaching creative writing at the university, and everybody else is busying away. Talented group of people.
It's interesting, when you have a group like that, if one of you has a breakup bestseller, which it looks like Orphan Monster Spy is set to be, do you think there'll be any jealousy?
No. I mean, I found very much that, everybody's success has, each individual's success has been everybody's success. My cohort is extremely, tight in that respect. And generally, I have found children's writing and writing for YA, that community is incredibly supportive of each other. I belong to the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators.
Right.
And we have, that is an incredibly supportive environment. Everybody is everybody else's cheerleader. Everybody else, people come to each other's events and because we're not really in competition, when children's books sell well, that is good for the publisher. It means there's more money to give people in advances, and I think we all believe profoundly that children reading is a good and valuable thing. So when people are successful, that means good things are happening in the world. I do know one children's writer who is also a poet, and we met at a retreat, and she was saying, everybody's so nice, this is amazing. And she said, I'm a poet, and poets are, and then she used an expletive,
which we're not allowed to use on the radio.
And so I don't think every literary sort of category is as supportive as we are, but I think it's we're very sort of tight and united. I mean, that's not to say that, you know, people don't individually go like, oh God, that's so successful. Why am I not? Because I think every human is like that. Every human feels that from time to time. I mean, I'm in a very privileged position, and, you know, I'm getting backing from a publisher, and yeah, I could look out and I can see like two or three other writers who are getting more coverage right now. There's, you know, the little voice inside going, ah, if you were better, you'd be being backed like that. But, you know, that's not reality.
If the world could do that, could get together like that and support one another, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think I think every human has an instinct, especially when, you know, you're discussing the Third Reich or something. I think all humans have an instinct to kind of sort of fear and anger, but also like the same capacity for sort of compassion. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, you need to acknowledge the sort of the anger side of yourself, but you can't let it rule you, because it's always the anger is always unreasonable, you know, and very little harm can ever come from, you know, somebody reacting from a place of compassion. You know,
that's right.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Matt Killeen, author of Orphan Monster Spy, which is a novel set in World War II. You know, you talk about it being a young adult novel, and of course it is, but when I was reading it, I wasn't even aware of that, because it's so gripping that,
right.
that I think it will appeal to adults every bit as much.
I mean, I think so.
Yeah.
I think, well, you know, well-written children's books and young adult books they should be able to appeal to sort of a wider age range. And particularly YA, because YA is really, essentially it's you know, what defines a young adult book is usually there is a younger protagonist than you would find in lit fic.
Right.
And also it's a little more concise. You cannot get away with any waffle. You know, there can be no fat on a children's book. Mm. You got to keep it lean.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, for people my age, which is in my 80s, see, I grew up during the Second World War, and every time I went to the movies, the newsreels were all about the war, and of course we had rationing, and you know everything, so it was very, I was really, really taken by this book because I saw the other side of what was going on, and we saw one side, and of course we weren't in the United States. We were, you know, insulated from a lot of things. But I remember once seeing the prisoners in a war camp when they liberated it in I think it was Auschwitz, and some of the horrible things we saw there, and it was, you know, it was very moving, and so
yeah.
I guess that's why I couldn't put this down, because I wanted to see what happened to this young girl.
Well, let's
she
talk
was something else.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the book and the main character, Sarah. How did Sarah just sort of come to you fully formed, Matt, or how did you develop her as a character?
Well, she kind of arrived fully formed. She was inspired by Violet Szabo, who was an agent for the SOE. The SOE were kind of secret agents that were dropped behind enemy lines and organized resistance and chaos. And, you know, those people who did that were taking an incredible risk, because they weren't prisoners. If they were captured, they weren't prisoners of war. They could only expect to be tortured and murdered. And Violet Szabo was, I kind of discovered, I knew her story very well, because there's a film with Virginia McKenna called Carve Her Name with Pride. And I discovered quite recently just how young she was when she died, and how young she was when she volunteered. She was just 21, and I was thinking, when I was 21, I was a mess, you know. There was no way I could have volunteered for a, you know, a suicide mission into enemy territory. And I wasn't much more mature at 21 than I had been at 17 or 15. And it was kind of that moment, you know, the idea of a 15-year-old agent that Sarah kind of dropped, pretty much fully formed at that point. I kind of knew she would be an outsider, so it made sense that she was Jewish. So she kind of dropped in, and her character was fairly fully formed. She has kind of written herself in many respects. As I write, she constantly surprises me with the things she says and the things she decides to do. You know, just coming out of my fingers, but particularly her and the captain when they're talking. I will be typing, and then she will say something, and I'm like, oh. And then he will answer, and I'm like, oh, okay, all right, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. So she kind of talks to me a little bit as well, and I mean, I like to think that's just a well-trained subconscious, and that's not, you know, I'm not crazy. And I mean, you know, a couple of examples of that is that initially in the idea I was thinking, well, the British agent would rescue her, and then I thought, well, no, that doesn't sound right at all. That doesn't sound like her. She would need rescuing. And so as I wrote it, it sort of just sort of came out that, like, she saves him, you know, she saves his life.
Yeah, I was going to say she rescues him, so, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I find it interesting that that young adult kind of action, suspense, thriller type stories these days seem to often have a female lead. And I know that's partially because girls read more than boys, but I love this trend. I love it. You know, I'm thinking Hunger Games. I'm thinking, I can't remember the name of the other, but a Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Of course, that wasn't really young adult. That was a little dark for young adult, maybe. But Twilight.
Yes, very brutal.
Pardon?
I said that, yeah, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo is extremely brutal.
Yeah.
You know, there's some debate as to whether she can be a truly feminist character, bearing in mind how abused she is.
Yeah.
I think you know, society is ready for some female heroes. You know, I think, you know, things have been changing for a while. I think that we as a society got to a very progressive point, and I think we kind of took it for granted. And, you know, when there was a swing back towards the right, I think it has been sort of a lot of creative people have sought to kind of redress that balance and sort of reestablish some good principles. I think that, you know, there are a lot of female writers, a lot of great female writers, and I think, female heroines are an interesting area because there is a sort of traditional idea of what constitutes a hero. And that can be very kind of male type behaviors, you know, being sort of violent or, you know, kick ass or isn't necessarily, you know, you can have very interesting female characters that are like that. Or you could have female characters that don't want to wear pink and they don't want to be princesses. But that in itself is a trope, you know. And I think I've always felt it is more important to have, like, well-written, deep, multifaceted female characters than it is to have strong ones. I think the strength is very often a kind of byproduct of the depth. If you look, I'm a big Hunger Games fan. I'm wearing a Hunger Games t-shirt right now. you know, Katniss is, although you can see, you know, she's really good with a bow and she's able to fight for herself. But her character's, the wellspring of all her strength is her compassion. All of this, she doesn't want to start a revolution. You know, she's only interested in protecting her sister. you know, that, and that's her surrogate daughter. She, like Sarah, is a young carer. She's caring for her sister, caring for her mother. And, you know, her anger is sort of directed towards her mother's weakness rather than the system that took her father away in the first place. But she, when she volunteers to be tribute, she isn't doing that with any idea of surviving at all. She does that to save her sister. She's swapping her life for her sister's. And she, because, you know, if you're District 12, you know, there has only ever been one District 12 winner, and that was long before she was born. And all the way through, she reacts, she's reacting with, she's trying to survive, but she's reacting with compassion. And this is what it is, her instinct and nurture that is the fire that lights the revolution. And, you know, she's not without a temper. And that also influences it. But, and I can't talk too much more without, like, spoilers. So, but I think she's a very interesting character in that respect.
I agree. I'm a big fan of Hunger Games, too. And I'm proud to say that I started reading the books before it became a phenomenon, before most adults knew about it, because one of my teenage nieces told me about it. So.
Yes. I went to a workshop with an agent a long time ago when I first thought that I might be an author, and I was thinking about writing that first book. And somebody said to her, she was from the States, and somebody said, so what's the next big thing? And she went, well, there's this book coming out. I think it's going to be dystopia is going to be the next big thing. There's this book coming out, you won't have heard of it, and it's not out over here, but it's called The Hunger Games. It's going to change everything. And so I was in the States a couple of weeks later, and I picked up the first edition, and I read it, and I went, yes, this is going to change everything.
Yeah.
definitely.
And in a way, Orphan Monster Spy is dystopia too, except it's historical dystopia.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think by that point, people were saying, don't try and write dystopia now, it's too late, you know, because by the time a trend sort of becomes, you know, marketable, it's already too late. You can't write a book. They'll be looking for the next thing by the time it's finished.
Right.
And so I kind of thought, well, this is dystopia-esque, basically. The Third Reich is one of the ultimate dystopias.
Absolutely. So, Matt, did you do a lot of research into the kind of the details of living in Germany during this time period?
I was building off quite a large knowledge base to begin with, so I was able to go, right, this is what the story is going to be, this is the rough framework. I did, as I went along in the story, I kind of like had this framework that had the beginning and the end and a couple of incidents along the way. And then I kind of wrote in between in chronological order, which allowed the characters to change the story or the research to change the story. So, I knew that she was going to be at a port trying to escape, and I looked, well, what port would that be? And then I was thinking, okay, so, Lake Constance, you can get a ferry over to Switzerland, that makes sense, and so that became Friedrichshafen, and then Friedrichshafen had zeppelins, and then that changed the story, and so that's an example of the way that the research can adapt the story. And for the emotional core, I mean, I read a lot of stuff, but the kind of the emotional core, the emotional authenticity, I've listened to a lot of oral histories. You know, we're very fortunate that great efforts have been made to capture the oral history of the Holocaust in particular, and the Second World War generally. Like the people who lived through that are beginning to pass away now, and so people have been making an effort to record the events of their lives. And so by listening to a lot of those, you can kind of hit that phrase or that incident that's described, which kind of sums up the whole. There are several conversations in the book and moments in the book that are inspired by real events that I've heard described. And that can be very emotionally very difficult. I mean, I watch lots of documentaries about the Holocaust, and I tend to watch them over and over again because you never know when you're going to pick up that little moment that brings it to life in your head, which you can use in a book. And so generally my wife goes like, "Why are you watching this again? You're crying again. Stop it." You know. There was one I was in when I was working at Lego. I used to sort of fly out to their U.S. head offices in Enfield in Connecticut, and so I'd flown out to work there for a weekend. So I was in this hotel room alone in a sort of small industrial town, and I was watching I think it was a Simon Wiesenthal film, feature length documentary, and it just all just got on top of me. I just found myself like curled up in a ball, sobbing. It was completely inconsolable because I just couldn't. It had just got on top of me entirely, you know, while I was alone.
Well, I can understand it. Yeah.
You know, growing up and learning about World War II and reading the Diary of Anne Frank, I always ask myself, what would I have done if I were there? And, you know, honestly, it kind of feels like I may find out the answer to that question over the next couple of years in the U.S., the way things are going.
It is
here.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very clearly obvious in the US right now, but it's taking place in the UK, it's taking place in other parts of Europe. But we have the same situation in embryo that led to the Third Reich. We have like massive inequality. We have some people who are incredibly socio and economically deprived who have just been cut off from society, who are angry and perhaps not the best informed, and then we have media and politicians who are willing to play upon fear and point and say it's the fault of the immigrants and it's the fault of the other person, and those are the people you should fear. And in, you know, we are in a world sort of on the cusp of that happening again, I think.
Did you have that in mind while you were writing that?
When I started, when it was sort of in embryo, and I was first thinking about it, you know, we had the war on terror, and I was seeing the way in which governments were using kind of fear to control the population, and you know, seeing how there were, you know, sort of corporate interests that were benefiting from that war, which, you know, has parallels with the way that the Third Reich was created. And I was also, people have a tendency to go, oh, well, that, you know, that couldn't happen here. And, you know, it will never happen again. And of course, it has happened. It's happened several times since. It will probably happen again. And because people forget that there wasn't a single country, all but one country that was occupied by the Nazis in the Second World War, they participated in the deportations of the Jews. The police helped round up Jews. You know, it happened everywhere, including in Britain. The Nazis occupied Guernsey, and in Guernsey, the British police helped deport the Jews to Auschwitz. And, you know, people go, that wouldn't happen.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That wouldn't happen here, but it did, you know.
Well,
there was only one country which didn't participate, and that was Denmark. And they basically decided, because they'd been occupied for a while, and then the word came down that they were going to deport all the Jews. And basically the Danes all decided, no, they're not. And they hid them. They took them out in boats. They rescued them from armed police, you know, in mobs. And it's a classic case of, you know, how resistance can change. Because people are always worried about, well, if I stand up and I'm on my own, am I going to get killed? Am my family going to get killed? The fact is that, you know, there is as much compassion as there is hate in the world. And when you stand up and you do what is right and other people see you, they will rally to you. And that's kind of what happened in Denmark. And I don't think there's anything particularly special about the Danes. I mean, right now they have some of the most draconian sort of anti-immigrant laws in place. It's just that just enough people at that moment stood up and did what was right, and everybody else rallied to it. When I do author visits in schools, I show the video, I don't know if you've ever seen it, of it's somebody filming this lone nutcase dance at a music festival, and on this hillside there's this one guy doing this really weird dancing. And this is why clearly somebody turned the camera on him to record it. And then somebody else goes up, and because somebody else goes up, a third guy does it, and then four, and then there's four of them together, and then that's a movement. And then, you know, within 2 or 3 minutes, the entire hillside is covered with thousands of people all doing this weird dance. Because that's kind of how it happens, you know?
You know, I had an experience like that myself once, where I came across a very serious accident on the road, and there was a semi and a pickup truck had collided, and I was one of the first ones there, but pretty soon cars were backed up on both sides of the road, and everyone was afraid to approach the pickup truck, where one man was hanging out of the truck over the seatbelt, you know, so he was bent over the seatbelt, he wasn't moving. The other one was trapped behind the steering wheel, and you know, I went from car to car and said, is anyone a doctor? Is anyone a nurse? And nobody was. And so finally I went over and started to try and help the guy. And then everybody came and tried to help. You know?
Absolutely.
I think we were all afraid. We didn't know what to do, but we had to do something, you know, so we cut him out of the seatbelt. And then he did end up living. So.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So, Matt, would you like to read a little bit from Orphan Monster Spy?
Okay, I'm going to read the beginning.
Great.
If that's okay.
Sure.
Right. Okay. So it's August 28th, 1939. Finally, the car came to a stop. With difficulty, Sarah opened her eyes, blinked to clear her vision, and looked up from her hiding place in the footwell. Her mother was slumped in the driver's seat, her head against the top of the steering wheel. She was gazing through the spokes to where Sarah was crouched. Her mother's eyes were almost the same, they were wide and pretty. Her pupils were so big Sarah could see herself in them. But now they seemed dull. Her mother was no longer in there. She reached out, but something hot dripped onto her hand, so she snatched it back. Her palm was bright red next to her white fingers. Lauf, dumm Schlampf. Sarah could hear the voice in her head, but her mother's lips weren't moving. Her nose was blocked and her eyes hurt. The pain was a fog across her thinking. Again she heard it. Lauf! Run! She looked at her mother's face once more, in time to see her forehead slide off the top of the wheel. The eyes, still staring, now regarded the floor. Lauf! Just run! Sarah thought her voice was her own. The door handle turned, but the door didn't open. She tried again. It opened a crack, but she was pushing against the whole weight of the door as if up a hill. Her hand was slick with blood, so she rubbed it on her coat and tried again. By sticking her shoulder against the door panel, she managed to heave it wide open, spilling the cold light of the evening into the car. She scrambled up and out. The Mercedes had come to rest in a ditch by the roadside, its nose buried in a warehouse fence. Sarah looked into the car and saw what the bullet had done to the back of her mother's head. She fought a wave of nausea as the door swung shut, but she felt nothing else. Not yet. Her heart was beating fast and loud in her ears, the air stinging her nose. Her neck felt hot. Behind her, the soldiers from the checkpoint were just rounding the distant corner that she and her mother had careened around moments ago, just before the shot. There were voices, shouts, running feet on the asphalt. Dogs began to bark. They were closing. Where now? What now? Lauf! Sarah flung herself onto the warm hood and crawled across it towards the break the car had made in the warehouse fence. The shards of broken windshield tore at her hands and knees. She slid off into the brambles and then pushed through them on all fours, picking up splinters of wood, thorns, and broken glass. Don't look back. Keep going. Ignore the pain in your hands and knees. Lauf! She let the voice run riot in her head as she broke through the fence. Was it her voice? Her mother's? It didn't matter. Onto your feet now. That's it. Lauf! Lauf! Run! Run! She sprinted into an alley between two old buildings, kicking up the sludge deposited by overflowing gutters. Looking up, she could see the rusting gutters hanging from the roof edges and the leaf litter that blocked the drains, about 2 meters high, too precarious. But this claustrophobic corridor continued into the distance, and she could hear the dogs closing. Get up there, dumb schlump. Don't call me that. Well, you're being one. What kind of gymnast are you? A Jewish gymnast, not permitted to compete. You'll be a dead Jewish gymnast if you don't move. Are you hardy, pious, cheerful, free? Sarah found herself laughing at the old saying. What would Jan, the father of gymnastics, think of a Jew? Deutschland's Unglück, Germany's misfortune, using those words as inspiration. So she put a skip into a step, ignoring the tightness in her calves, the pain in her neck, the chance of slipping, repeating, frisch, fromm, freilich, free, hardy, pious, cheerful, free, with her eyes on the gutter all the way. She launched herself up into the air, caught the troughs neatly on each side, and swung herself up and to the right, the metal creaking and complaining as she went. She hit the corrugated iron roof with a crash, slid for a second, and stopped just shy of the roof's edge. Beat that, Trudy Meyer. I'll have your gold medal now, Danka. She lay unmoving, staring into the vast and darkening silver sky, the scent of triumph slowly ebbing away like a light in the west. It was leaving a cold sensation in her stomach. If she couldn't calm her breathing, they would hear her. She thought about the last look back into the Mercedes and then pushed that memory away. She put it into the special box and closed the lid. She looked at the emptiness above and listened. Over her heaving chest, she could hear the dogs. The shouting grew closer. There were muffled footsteps. A soldier was walking between the buildings. The noise was too indistinct to work out how far away she was, and her breathing was too loud, much too loud. She counted 2 seconds, took one last long breath, and clamped her mouth shut. She realized she could just make out a star where the sky was darkest. She also discovered she couldn't breathe through her nose, so all she had to do was keep her lips together. Footsteps right below her. A star? A planet? Was it Venus? The foot stopped. Planet. Star. There was movement, the sound of material scraping against the brickwork. The gutter creaked. Her chest began to throb as the pressure grew. There was a loud breathing and the sound of boots against the wall. More pressure, more pain, the urge to spring to her feet and run away. She turned her head very slowly to see thick, dirty fingers gripping the lip of the gutter. Inside her head, she began to scream. She wanted to open her mouth and let it out. So much. At that moment, there was a snap, a tearing, and a shriek. The gutter, the dirty fingers, and the heavy breathing vanished in a cascading crash. There was swearing, shouting, catcalls, laughter, footsteps receding, quiet, distant barking. Sarah opened her mouth and let the breath explode out of her lungs. She gulped down the cool air. Her shoulders rose and fell and rose again because she couldn't stop them, and she began quietly to sob.
And that was Matt Killeen reading from Orphan Monster Spy. So, Mom, I know you had some questions about the school.
He said he did a lot of research. Did they really have schools like that for the girls? They weren't supposed to be scholastically good. They were just training people to be brutal. Was that what they did?
Well, the Napola schools existed. I kind of had it in my head that this place would exist. I read a lot of in my early adolescence. I read a lot of Enid Blyton, the Mallory Towers books, and you know, boarding school stories. And mm-hmm. So I kind of in my head that was sort of the basis of it. And then I sort of did some research and discovered that the Napola schools did exist. They were training. They were sort of, in a way, SS academies mm-hmm. for the most Aryan people. And I kind of had assumed that there wouldn't actually have been school for girls because the women were sort of walking wombs essentially. And weren't expected right. to participate in the war, but it turned out that there were actually a couple of Napola schools for girls, and so there's very little written about them. I think a lot of the people who went, I think were insecure about talking about them. I know that the boys' schools had a real reputation for brutality. And sort of in line with sort of, you know, army training and SS training. And so I've had to sort of, in many ways imagine what the girl's education would have been like based on what the BDM, which was sort of the girls' Hitler Youth, the kind of things that they did, the kind of things that they were taught, and the kind of political education which I knew took place. So, but there's very little written about her. So in part, this is in part a sort of imaginative creation, but it's kind of based on sort of a lot of strands of good research.
Well, yeah. No, of course, Sarah being blonde, she was not suspected to be Jewish.
Yes.
And that's what saved her initially, being able to get into the school, right?
Yes. I've had a lot of people writing to me, a lot of, I'm blonde and blue-eyed and I'm Jewish. Really identified with this character. Yeah.
How did, when she was back in her hometown with her mother and was being picked on, or, well, more than picked on, being chased and assaulted for being Jewish, how did people know she was Jewish then?
I think that in a lot of the small communities, people knew who was Jewish and who wasn't. Particularly the character of Sarah, when she ends up in Vienna, she is in the Jewish quarter and very clearly part of the Jewish community. So
I got the impression that she was never Orthodox. She never didn't. You didn't follow all the rituals or anything, though, did she?
No, but that didn't—that did not matter to the Nazis, really.
No, I know.
There were a great many, very inverted commas, integrated Germans who happened to be of Jewish blood, who were surprised and sort of outraged that they were, lumped in with
mm-hmm.
everybody else.
The
Jews had been part of German society for as long as Germany had existed as a country, and there were war heroes and the lawyers and doctors and judges who'd been who were as suddenly found themselves to be second class citizens. That's not to say that anybody should have been treated that way, but it the fact that there were those who did not consider themselves Jewish, who considered themselves part of sort of the great German experiment, were suddenly found themselves on the outside.
There was even some rumor I read somewhere that Hitler had some Jewish blood in his ancestry, and so that I'm sure that was, well, who knows, it could have been.
It's a hotly debated topic. I mean, there were levels of sort of psychopathy in place anyway. I know he was very much, his anti-Semitism was kind of like goes sort of way back into his childhood. I know that he was, if I'm trying to remember the story correctly, he was rejected academically at some point by someone who happened to be Jewish, and he took that was part of the great Jewish conspiracy, as opposed to just accepting that maybe he wasn't the great student or the great artist that he thought he was.
So Matt, I've read that Orphan Monster Spy was the subject of a competitive 9-house auction, and you made a comment earlier about your agent being excellent. So I'm guessing there's a story to this.
It kind of goes back. I was at, I talked earlier about the Society of Children's Writers, children's book writers and illustrators. I was at one of their retreats, and there I ran into an editor who sort of read the beginning of the book, and she went, "Ah, this is excellent. I love it. Please send it the whole thing immediately." And I was kind of, "Oh, I don't know. I'm still rewriting it. I'm all insecure about it." And she said, "Well, do you have an agent?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Right. Well, that's the first thing you need to do. And I'll give you a list of 6 names and approach them and say that I sent you." And so that was good. Then I kind of immediately got to the top of the slush pile because I was saying I've just been sent by so-and-so from HarperCollins. And the kind of the first person to reply was Molly at the Bent Agency. And I you know, it, as it happens, I met a few other agents, but, you know, I met Molly that first time. We talked for 3.5 hours. About halfway through, actually, I said, oh, and if you wanted to represent me, and she went, oh, I'm going to represent you. Is that not clear? I mean, I'm married to a New Yorker, and Molly is an American living in the UK, and so, you know, sort of formidable American woman. I thought, oh, okay, I know that. I know what the rules are there. So, and she, anyway, Molly was very good. She gave me time to, because at that point I was trying to move house because I just had a baby, and I'd kind of like reacquired my 19-year-old, and I had a dog who was just like really neurotic, and so I kind of had a lot of personal life stuff going on, and so she gave me the time to kind of do that, and then I can't remember the exact chronology, but she sort of came to me and said, right, I've gone through the. She's a very good editor herself, so she said, I've gone through the manuscripts, and these are my notes. And she said she'd been talking about it with people, and she wanted to take it to Bologna. That would have been last year. And so I worked on the edits, and that, you know, edits are hard for a writer because you sit and you work by yourself, and, you know, if something sucks you, it's entirely your own fault. You know, that's the good and bad thing about being a writer. And so having somebody come in and say, you know, having opinions about your work it can be very, very difficult, because it's like the first time in a long time that you've had to sort of take them on board. There's a friend of mine, S.S. Saeed, children's writer, and he said that all authors say, oh, yes, I want constructive feedback, and actually all authors just want to be told that it's brilliant and not going to change anything.
Exactly.
So I worked through Molly's notes, and then it never got to Bologna that people read it and got very excited about it, and the auction process is very, very strange and, you know, surreal situation. But I mean, there were several publishers and editors who were vying for the book, and they were saying they all had a personal story. One of them was a second generation Holocaust survivor. Other one who'd been editing a lot of Holocaust fiction, and they all had a personal stake in it. I think that's one of the reasons that it was sort of so hotly contested, is, you know, these people wanted to be involved in the book and sort of felt that it was an important thing.
So was it published in the US or the UK first?
In the UK by about 12 days. Came out in the UK on the 8th, and on the 8th of March, and it came out in the US last week on the 20th.
And you're now in the US doing a book tour.
I'm doing I'm doing radio, and I just had the US launch. I was over in February doing a big tour.
Oh, okay.
And I got to experience sort of Minnesota winter, which, because last time I was in Minnesota, it was summer, and I said, well, I know it's cold, so I'm going to look it up. And it said, you know, feels like minus 27 Celsius. And I was like, well, what does minus 27 Celsius feel like? I can't even imagine what that might feel like. So
now you know.
Yeah. Now I know, yes. There was a reason I went out in the streets looking for the nightclub where Prince filmed Purple Rain, and the streets were deserted, and I was like, I wonder why the streets are deserted. And of course, because everybody else in the city was inside because they were sensible. So I took my selfies outside the club, and then I walked like literally just around the corner to go to Target to buy milk, and like I arrived at Target and I was like crying. It was so cold. Yeah.
Well, come back when it's nice. Yeah. Although winter, we're not quite through with winter yet. It's a little discouraging.
Yes.
Yep.
Well, we're about out of time, and I want to really thank you for being with us today, Matt. This book is
no problem. Thank you for having me.
Is absolutely a page turner. Can't put down. Got to find out what happens to Sarah.
Yeah, and I think it's appropriate for all ages. I mean, high school to elderly people that went through the war. I really do. It's just amazing.
Mom, do you have any closing words for us today?
Yes, I do. Molière once said, "It is not only for what we do that we are held responsible, but also for what we do not do." I think that fits here.
I think it does. Okay, see you all next week on Writer's Voices. Thank you.